I had no idea what was going to happen to Jason, either in criminal court or civil. The only thing I knew was that I had to protect myself, and mostly I had to protect Spencer. I would take half of our assets, and I would take Spencer. And if Jason asked about us, I'd reassure him that he had been Spencer's father all these years, without legal documentation. We could be whatever we wanted to each other, regardless of a piece of paper. I was halfway done stacking the pantry when my phone rang. It was the realtor who had sold us the carriage house 2 years earlier, returning my call. She was coming over the next day to take a look around before setting a list price. 47. Corinne left Harlem at exactly 2:31 p.m. on Saturday for Port Washington, making a point to mark her time. She arrived at Carrie Lynch's house at 3:12 p.m. Departing from Greenwich Village would have been farther. The Saturday afternoon traffic was probably worse than a Wednesday night. So 40 minutes minimum from Jason Powell's house to here was a good estimate, if he had traveled by car. She had already searched the data from the license plate readers on the bridges and tunnels, looking for any evidence that Powell's Audi wagon had left Manhattan on Wednesday. She didn't find a hit. In theory, he could have gone by train or used a different vehicle, but in her gut, Corinne wasn't feeling it. The first time she went to Carrie's house, she hadn't realized how isolated it was. Now that Carrie was missing, she was certain that someone could come and go without a neighbor noticing. A marked Port Washington police car pulled to the curb behind her a few minutes after she arrived. The man who stepped out was younger than she had expected, based on their phone calls. He was probably in his late 30s, with dark brown hair and a neatly trimmed beard. "I brought you donuts," said Duncan. He extended a half-dozen box of Krispy Kremes, and they each helped themselves to one. "Come on, humor me. Tell me I'm the very first person to make that joke." She finished swallowing before answering. "You should know I hate puns, but I love a good donut nutter, so you get a pass." "Fair enough." He led the way behind the house, removed two ribbons of crime scene tape, and opened the back door. He held out an arm to stop her from walking any further than halfway through the kitchen. "Have you contacted her family?" Corinne asked. "Mom's passed. Dad's got Alzheimer's in Indiana. Estranged from her brother there. From what I can tell, she was all about her job. Some friends at work, like Samantha, but just casual socializing outside of the office. Not anyone close."
"Where's Snowball?"
"Yeah, just had to ask me that, didn't you?" His embarrassed smile was sweet.
"Really? You've got her dog?"
"She's so cute."
"Hey."
Corinne remembered Carrie correcting her when she was here before. "Technically, but Snowball transcends labels. Carrie's brother wouldn't take the poor thing. And Samantha said she's allergic, even though I told her Bichons are hypoallergenic."
"We're on day 3. Don't you think it's about time you started processing this as a crime scene?"
"Well, 72 hours is our general rule of thumb, but there's been a development. When I went through her phone looking for our mystery man, Jay, I found phone calls to realtors. Apparently she was looking to list her house, and fast. She said she wanted it priced to sell."
"That could mean anything."
"Maybe she took off for a couple of days to go wherever she was planning to move. She did leave Snowball's automated food and water bowls totally filled."
"Without her purse and her phone?"
Nutter shrugged. "I know, but those real estate calls have to be related. That can't be a coincidence."
"And just so you know, she told me herself she was kind of a crappy dog owner, leaving Snowball alone all the time. That's probably why she had those feeders. If I had to guess, she probably kept them full all the time. Do you mind if I take a look around?"
He obviously had no idea what was permitted under the current circumstances.
"I want to look in the living room. It's the only part of the house I saw when I was here before."
She made her way to the threshold of the kitchen entrance and stood there for a full 5 minutes, scanning the entire room in small sections. She noticed only one thing out of place, but it was important. Once she told Nutter, it would change the way he was looking at the case. She asked him what the plan was for interviewing the person who had delivered food to Carrie the last night she was seen. Nutter looked at his watch. "Perfect timing. We're supposed to meet him at the restaurant in 10. She climbed into her car, pulled a U, and followed Nutter. Based on what she'd gleaned about the delivery boy, Corinne was expecting someone around 20 years old, surfer by day, Italian food delivery guy by night. Instead, they pulled in front of the restaurant, called Grapevine, to find a guy older than either of them, probably 50, a surfboard still strapped to the top of his Honda Prius. He introduced himself as Nick Lowe.
"No, not the musician, if you've even heard of him. It's Dominic, legally. My parents called me Nick, and I figured, yeah, let's go with that."
She noticed the air freshener hanging from Nick's rearview mirror. She let Netter take the lead. It didn't take long for Nick to confirm what they already knew. He had delivered a takeout order to Carrie's house on Wednesday night. If the receipt said the order left at 6:30, he estimated he arrived around 6:45. Maybe 7:15. There's a lot of orders, plus suburban sprawl. The carbon footprints are large around here. Do you remember anything about her demeanor?
Netter asked.
I don't know. She took the bag of food, handed me a $5 for a tip, and that was basically it. She's a good person, you guys. She like works all the time and eats at home. She's kind of sad. Why are you asking about her?
Corinne realized why it had taken this long to get a statement from Nick. Netter had never explained that they were asking because they were concerned about Carrie. Nick obviously thought she was the suspect. Netter struck her as a decent guy, but she was done letting him call the shots.
You deliver to her house regularly? Corinne asked.
Oh, yeah, sure. Every couple of weeks or so, I'd say.
Nick, to our knowledge, you were the last person to see Miss Lynch, she said. We can't find her and are concerned about her safety. His brow furrowed. What else did you notice that night? She asked.
Well, her boyfriend was there.
His tone was more serious now, focused.
That was different.
Fuck. They could have found this out 2 days earlier. She pulled out her phone and searched for a photograph of Jason Powell. This guy?
No, not him.
Something about the way he said it. But you've seen him before?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, wait, isn't he on the news?
He is, for various things. But did you see him with Carrie Lynch?
Yeah. Maybe once, twice the most. He definitely looks familiar, like he's British or something. Not an accent or anything. I never spoke to him, but that kind of vibe. I'd say he was there, maybe 3 or 4 months ago.
Netter interrupted.
You said there was a man there on Wednesday. Was his name Jay?
Nick shrugged.
I don't know any name other than what's on the order. Customers make shit up, too. Huge ass, Seymour butts. People kind of suck.
But you said she had a boyfriend over, Corinne said, trying to get Nick back on track.
Yeah, or at least he used to be. But it was a long time ago, like more than a year, two, maybe even 3 years ago. He used to be there a lot. He would answer the door and tip me and everything. I thought he lived there. Then I stuck my foot in my mouth and was like, hey, where's your husband? And she said he was a scumbag. And all of a sudden on Wednesday, he was back again. That same guy.
Corinne Googled Tom Fisher Oasis on her phone and hit images. She clicked on the first image in the results. Does this guy look familiar?
Yeah, that's the guy. He's the one who was there on Wednesday. She's okay, right? She's a nice lady.
Corinne and Netter walked together to the far corner of the parking lot where they had left their cars side by side.
So who's the dude?
He asked. Her boss. They had an affair 3 years ago. She told me it didn't end well. He stayed with his wife.
Oh, shit. And she kept working for him?
Yes, but it wasn't comfortable. At least that's what she said. She threatened to sue, so she was able to keep her job.
Like a cop who barely makes it out of a beef with his badge. It's never quite the same again. That would be the work trouble her friend mentioned.
And the reason she said Carrie had a weakness for the wrong guys, Corinne added.
So this might not be related to your case at all?
It was barely a question the way Netter said it.
Hard to say, but I don't think she left on her own. When I was at the house, I did notice one thing. She had a big crystal egg on the coffee table. My guess is around 10 or 15 pounds. It's gone.
The dog walker didn't notice.
It's not the dog walker's job to notice. Corinne could already picture it. The dining room table cleared, the dirty takeout containers on the kitchen counter, the glass eggs smashing against Carrie's head. Blood on her dark hair, moving the body, no neighbors in sight. Someone cleaning blood from either the hardwood floors in the living room or the terracotta tile in the kitchen. Maybe even leaving all that food and water for Snowball.
I'll call the crime scene now,
Netter said again.
Why didn't you say something at the house?
I wasn't sure what to make of it until we talked to the delivery guy.
Or you wanted to make sure you still got to tag along while I was still assuming she'd turn up.
You should make that call, Netter.
It took Corinne nearly 2 hours to tell Netter everything she knew about Carrie Lynch, including Jason Powell's suspicions that Carrie might have known more than she was admitting about Oasis's international dealings. She spent another hour giving him advice on the various steps he might take to work the case now that it was becoming clear that this investigation belonged in Long Island. She had just pulled into the LIE when her phone rang. She didn't recognize the number, but the area code was Manhattan.
This is Duncan,
Hey, it's Brian.
He was Brian again. From your cell phone on a Saturday. No, I won't go out with you.
You should be so lucky. Any updates on Carrie?
She hadn't spoken to King since Thursday when she first found out Carrie was missing. She told him she was driving back from Port Washington and gave him a quick summary of what she'd learned there.
So you think Jason Powell is this boyfriend she called Jay? The surfer guy saw them together.
Unclear. There's a Jay of some sort who might or might not be Powell. I wouldn't bet my life on surfer guy as an eyewitness.
And yet you trust him about seeing Tom Fisher there Wednesday night.
She recognized the inconsistency. He seemed certain about Fisher. Powell, not so much.
So are you interviewing Fisher?
How can I? I was already stretching to say if Powell left the city to target her, we had a basis for jurisdiction.
But Fisher?
Their entire relationship was on the island. If my suspicions about that missing glass egg are right, that crime also happened in Long Island. Not to mention I'm not even on duty.
Like that would stop you. I can spot a fellow's sucker for truth and justice.
She did, in fact, want to question Fisher herself. But she knew that she had outworn her welcome with Netter. The second she told him about that missing egg, he had kicked into a higher gear. King was silent on the other end of the line, thinking.
Don't tell anyone I said this, because it's cold as hell.
Hell's not cold.
Don't bust my balls, okay? I hope Carrie's fine, but oh shit, I'm actually glad this case is on hold. Gives me an easy out on this phone call I need to return.
Which is?
I check my office voicemail, which I should never do on a weekend, note to self. Had a message from Eric Jordan. He said he'd heard that Carrie Lynch was missing and was wondering if we had opened a grand jury to investigate.
Corinne let the information sink in. Eric Jordan was with New Day. His co-host, Susanna Coleman, was best friends with Angela Powell. It couldn't be a coincidence. If the news of Carrie's disappearance were going to leak from someone on Long Island, she'd expect it to be to one of the local media outlets, not to a national network morning show. It's coming from the wife. Corinne explained the common link between Angela Powell and Eric Jordan. He specifically asked about a grand jury? Oh, that seems weird. I should have known something was off when she came to the door in her pajamas.
I feel like you started having an entirely different conversation at some point.
Sorry, I'm thinking out loud. The first time I went to the Powell's house, Angela was cool as a cucumber, even as I told her about her husband hiring a prostitute. There was something almost Stepfordy about her. The house was impeccable, despite a teenage son under the roof and her husband in the middle of an investigation. But when I showed up Thursday, she came to the door in her pajamas in the middle of the afternoon. The more Corinne thought about it, the more convinced she was that Angela Powell had been off that day. She'd explained her appearance by saying she had a migraine, but Angela didn't seem like the type to reveal any kind of personal detail, let alone a weakness, to a stranger, let alone a police detective investigating her husband.
A second ago, it sounded like you thought Carrie and Tom Fisher might actually have been framing Powell all along, just like he claimed. Now you think Powell's wife is lying about his alibi?
I'm not sure what's going on at this point, except that Eric Jordan's phone call to you was no coincidence. He mentioned a grand jury? That almost seems like a suggestion. Maybe Angela has something to say, and her friend Susanna knows it will take a grand jury subpoena to get her to say it. Corinne had been telling herself that Angela's background had nothing to do with Jason's case, but now she was wondering whether Angela might be more submissive than she let on. She passed two exits before King spoke again.
As far as I'm concerned, my case is on hold. Hopefully, by the time it's not, we'll have some answers one way or the other.
And what if Powell's been telling the truth the whole time?
Are you fucking with me? You were just telling me to open a grand jury to question his wife.
Because I know we're missing something. I just don't know what it is yet.
Work your other cases, Duncan. You really drove out to Long Island on your day off?
Poor Washington. It's barely past Queens.
You're still making me feel bad. I'm going to go drink a bottle of wine and tell myself that Carrie Lynch is on an island somewhere reading a book.
48. By Sunday, the realtor had decided to list the carriage house for $7.5 million, half a million more than we paid for it. We would end up losing more than that to her commission, legal fees, and taxes, but if it all worked out as planned, we'd have about $1.7 million in equity to show for it, all of Jason's book money, and then some, half of which would be mine, at least legally. Jason had handled the news exactly as I expected, objectively and rationally. We were divorcing on paper only. From the moment he told me that his DNA would match whatever evidence Carrie Lynch had provided to the police, I had said I would stand by him, and we'd figure out where he and I stood later. This, objectively and rationally, was consistent with that plan. On my behalf, Colin had served Jason with divorce papers at his apartment on Saturday. I had printed the documents off the internet myself, trying to restrict Colin's involvement to the role of messenger. As it turned out, New York had only recently adopted a form of no-fault divorce, and even that wasn't exactly straightforward. It required at least one party to allege that the marriage had broken down irretrievably for a period of at least 6 months. I was certain we didn't meet the requirement until I read further. The lack of any physical intimacy counted as broken down irretrievably. We had been broken, as far as the law was concerned, for 3 years. I hadn't even realized it. My bare-bones documents weren't enough to actually render us divorced. The process required us to divide our marital property and reach an agreement on spousal support. One simplification was Spencer. He was my child, not Jason's, at least legally. And this entire arrangement was about legalities. Only 2 hours after Colin broke the news to him, Jason had come back home. We went through our financial statements and filled out the affidavits that we'd need to give to the divorce lawyer Colin had recommended. It felt like the paperwork we filed when we got the loan for the carriage house we were now selling. He held me all night as we slept, but we were practically silent as I helped him pack the things he'd need for a while and drove him the few blocks to Colin's apartment. He reached for the car handle and then stopped.
It's only on paper, right?
Jason, we talked about this.
I know, you need time. I hurt you. But Angela, I love you. I always have, and that's not changing. I really screwed up. I don't know how to tell you how sorry I am for where we are right now, but you are everything to me, always. If this is your way of telling me...
No, it's like I said. We're doing this for us, Jason, all three of us. I had a good shot at protecting at least half of Jason's money in the event he was hit with a major damage award. Colin said Carrie's case would get dismissed if she remained missing, but we had no guarantees of that. I was being practical.
You're amazingly strong. Do you know that?
I gave him a sad smile. A little bit. He kissed me on the cheek. As he made 3 trips into Colin's building, I sat alone at the wheel, frozen. 49. Corinne watched from her unmarked vehicle on Union Square West as Jason Powell made a second trip from the Audi into the sleek glass building around the corner on 15th Street. Angela remained in the driver's seat of the station wagon, hatchback popped open, the engine idling. From Corinne's vantage point, it appeared as if Angela were staring straight ahead, both hands still on the wheel. She had spotted the Powell's Audi backing out of their driveway when she was still a block from their house. She had hoped to catch Angela alone, but decided to follow them instead. The delivery of boxes a few blocks away could mean anything, but something about Angela's gaze into the distance told Corinne that the boxes weren't the only thing being dropped off here. As Powell made a third trip into the building, he paused and turned back toward the curb. Corinne couldn't make out his expression, but the moment struck her as sad. Angela drove away alone. Thanks to the direction of the one-way streets involved, Corinne had a head start. When Angela pulled into her driveway, Corinne was standing in front of the garage door. Instead of asking Corinne to move, Angela parked the car in the driveway and stepped out. It's not a good time, Detective. I'll be quick. Is your migraine gone? Yes, thanks. I actually tried that vinegar and honey trick. I think it may have helped. It was a good answer, but Corinne noticed the pause when she first asked the question. Corinne was certain now. There had been no migraine, and Angela Powell was not the kind of woman who stayed in her pajamas all day without a reason. What else had she been lying about? Did you keep my business card? Corinne asked, following Angela to the front stoop. I told you to call me 24/7 for any reason. I know, and I didn't call. And yet here you are on a Sunday afternoon. What am I missing, Detective? If you're called into a grand jury and asked what you know about your husband, what are you going to say, Angela? That's a strange question. Do you want us to subpoena you? I know you don't believe me, but I really am trying to help you. By asking me whether I want to testify about my husband in front of a grand jury? That's an odd form of assistance. I know you had your friend Susanna send a hint to the DA's office. If you have something to say and want the cover of a grand jury, I can arrange that. If you're afraid of Jason, I am not afraid of my husband. Maybe not now. Now that he's moved out. Angela's face fell as she realized the implication of Corinne's statement. You were watching us? You might think this is over, but it's only just beginning. Carrie Lynch has been missing for 4 days now. She left her dog, her ID, her credit cards, everything. Based on other evidence at the house, I don't think she left on her own accord. If Jason wasn't here Wednesday night, we need to know that. I have nothing else to say to you, Detective. You told me he was home having dinner with you and watching movies that night, like any normal couple. But now he's moving out. Something's not right here. Leave, Detective, or I'll report you for harassment. All right. But like I said, call me whenever you want. 50. I didn't bother with a hello. What did you do? When Susanna asked what I was talking about, I could tell immediately she was feigning confusion. You're the one friend I can trust right now, and you're lying to me. Stop it. That detective was here again, saying you sent some kind of hint to the district attorney. Something about me testifying in front of a grand jury? What did you do? I'm trying to protect you, Angela, by sending a cop to my door, by forcing me to go to court? I asked you point blank yesterday whether you would lie for Jason if you got subpoenaed. You promised me that you wouldn't. I had hoped my suspicions were somehow wrong. And so you tried to make that happen. I can't believe you did that to me. For you, Angela. I did it for you, not to you. All I did was ask Eric to make a call to see if they were opening a grand jury. Frankly, it wasn't easy for me to ask a jerk for a favor. Don't make it sound like I should be grateful to you for this. You stabbed me in the back. You have no idea the kind of danger you're putting me in. Danger? Are you kidding me? Do you know the ethical compromises I've made over and over again since this happened, completely out of loyalty to you? I work for the news division of a major network, and I'm keeping company with an accused rapist, one whose career I helped launch. Then you go and falsify an alibi for him to the police. Never once have you acknowledged the position that puts me in. I was furious at her for trying to manipulate the situation, but even I could see she had a valid point. This entire time I had been leaning on her for support, knowing that she would put our friendship over her job. I tried to set aside my own emotions to thank her now. I also apologize for only thinking about myself. I wouldn't be upset if you were actually looking out for number one, she said. But you're not. You're protecting Jason at your own peril. Spencer, too. So yes, that's why I tried to get you back on track with that call to the DA's office. I thought that if they opened a grand jury to look into Carrie's disappearance, it would give you a chance to come clean. He moved out today, I said suddenly. Jason, he went to Collins. And I served him with divorce papers last night, so you can stop trying to take care of us. I'm doing what I need to do. I made the decision on my way back from your house yesterday, so you had already helped, Susanna. Why didn't you tell me? I don't think I was ready to say it out loud yet, and it's all moving so fast. We packed what he needed for now. We're going to sell the house. I still couldn't believe I was in this situation and the drastic steps I'd need to take to get out of it. You're doing the right thing. I know, I said quietly. I'm sorry about the call to the DA. I was just so frustrated when you left yesterday. It's okay, Susanna, I understand. I won't ever stop trying to run your life, you know. Her voice was softer now. We're okay? Of course. So, at the risk of prying again too soon, is this breakup for real or strictly on paper? She had been the one to suggest a technical divorce, if only to protect us financially. He told her he would leave me for her. The words surprised me once they were out of my mouth. He admitted that to you? No, to his lawyer. Now that I'd opened that door, I owed her a more complete explanation. I've been reading his emails. All that nonsense about her company and kickbacks and whatever. He told Olivia he thought Carrie was pissed because he hadn't left me yet. So she framed him for sexual assault? Apparently. So you still think he's innocent? Of that? Yes. When I first saw the police reports Olivia sent to Jason, I believed he was guilty. It was the photographs of her wrists that convinced me. Her description of the way he suddenly seemed like a different person. Without one email, I became convinced that he had done to her what he had done to me. And she was willing to label that as rape, precisely as Susanna had argued. That was why I had kicked him out of the house that night. But how can you be sure? Susanna asked. Because I read the explanation he gave to his lawyer. Just trust me, Susanna, it all makes sense. She set him up, I'm sure of it. Normally she would have pressed me for details, but she let it go, no doubt sensing that she had pushed me far enough for the day. Are you okay? Do you want me to come over? No, I'm fine. I'm actually looking forward to being on my own for a while. You know, I've never lived alone before. Not once. This might be good for me. Spencer called me that night. I couldn't believe how much had changed in the 2 weeks since I drove him to camp. How's the arm? Still there?
Yeah, it's actually getting better already, but don't tell Kate. She's been, like, super nice to me.
It was sort of her fault I got it. I mean, she was all, that stuff looks like poison ivy, but it's not.
That's worse than not noticing in the first place, right?
Are you doing okay up there, otherwise?
Other than getting poisoned by nature under a counselor's watch? Yeah, I'm fine. It's pretty fun up here.
It's only another week, huh?
Is it? You mentioned before it might be 6 weeks instead of three.
I shut my eyes and took another drink of wine. I couldn't believe I had ever thought that this would all be over by then.
No, unless, of course, you want to stay.
I'd have to put the rest of the fees on a credit card.
I'm actually kind of ready to come home, but I like it here, too. Mom, what's going on? Did Dad's thing get taken care of? Is it over?
I closed my eyes, searching for an honest response. It's going to take longer than we thought, and Dad's going to stay at Collins for a while. After what happened, we thought we'd have a better chance working things out if we lived apart for a while.
You kicked him out.
No, Mom, he cheated on you and you need a break. You can tell me that. It's more complicated, but yes, we're on a break.
Good.
He's still your father. They had finally talked Friday night when Spencer called, the first time since Jason told him about the affair.
I know, and I'll be fine with him someday, but he's the one who screwed up, not you. You can stop protecting me.
I don't want you to spend your whole summer hearing bad things about your family.
Well, the stuff I've been imagining is probably way worse than what's actually happening.
I couldn't believe how smart my kid was.
Mom?
Yeah?
Do you want me just to come home? I can handle it, I promise.
I sucked in my breath. I had given myself so many pep talks about finally living on my own. I didn't need Jason, I didn't need anyone. You don't mind?
Definitely not. Everyone's starting to stink up here. We take showers and somehow we get smellier every day.
My laugh was more of a snort. I missed my kid. I told Kate I'd be picking Spencer up tomorrow. 51. Corinne woke up Monday morning to a call out at Columbia University. What was her early morning was the middle of the night for a college student. For all the headlines about college responses to sexual assaults on campus, universities seemed to be getting worse, not better, in their procedures. By the time Corinne arrived, the victim had already spoken to three friends, a student residence advisor, a faculty mentor, a student services counselor, and a university health clinic nurse. Only the nurse had encouraged the woman to call the police department. From what Corinne could gather, the rest of the crew spent that time convincing the woman that the police would arrest her for using ecstasy with the suspect the night before, that she could file a complaint through the university system, and that criminal charges could ruin the suspect's life. By the time Corinne got to SVU, it was a little after noon. She found a thick mailing envelope on her desk chair. It was from the Pittsburgh Police Department. She opened it to find the report she had ordered when she first learned that Angela Powell had once been Angela Mullen, the girl recovered after police fatally shot Charles Franklin near the Canadian border. Corinne flipped through the pages. Photographs of the house that had been Angela Powell's prison for 3 years, including two unmade twin beds and a crib with soiled linens. A doctor's report describing Angela's refusal to let anyone else hold the baby until her mother showed up. An FBI agent's report detailing Daniel and Virginia Mullen's threat to sue if their daughter and grandson weren't released to come home immediately. Background on Charles Franklin. One arrest for indecent exposure outside a public restroom, but no conviction. Child pornography found in the house. The typical statements from neighbors saying he seemed so normal. A printout of a photograph of him on a gurney. His face already gray and bloated, blood clotted in his dark brown hair. Even in death, Charles Franklin exhibited physical traits Corinne recognized from photographs of Angela's son, Spencer. The dark hair, wide nose, low forehead. She hoped that there was some part of Angela's brain that protected her from seeing the resemblance. Toward the bottom of the pile, she found the documents describing the discovery of the second victim, the one Angela had been instructed to call Sarah after Franklin brought her back to the home 2 years earlier. Franklin told Angela he finally got lucky on a trip to Cleveland when a girl even dumber than you accepted the offer of a ride home while waiting for a bus across the street from a shopping mall. He threatened to kill them both if they spoke a word of their previous existence under his roof, but Angela remembered Sarah telling her once that the only thing worth seeing where she grew up was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She was 14 years old when Franklin abducted her, making her about 16 when it was all over. The girl's decomposed body had washed up near the Pennsylvania-Ohio state line nearly 2 weeks after Franklin dumped her in Lake Erie. 2 bullet wounds at the base of her skull. Putrefaction had taken its toll. She was unrecognizable. A tattoo approximately 3 inches by 2 on her right hip was unidentifiable, too, other than the fact of its existence. The most recent document in the file was written almost a year and a half after Franklin was fatally shot during the rescue. The police and FBI had searched all missing person reports from Ohio and the surrounding states, but nothing matched the description they were able to provide of Sarah. The case, for all practical purposes, was closed. As far as Corinne could tell, no one had ever come forward to claim Sarah as their child. The parents who had allowed a 14-year-old to get a tattoo must not have looked especially hard when she disappeared. Corinne felt empty when she had finished reading. Death wasn't a good enough punishment for a savage like Charles Franklin. Corinne started to carry the file to the shredder, but stopped herself. She found space at the back of her bottom desk drawer. She'd keep it there for a while, just in case she needed it. 52. 2 days later.
The Long Island Press has the story.
It was Brian King on the phone. Corinne didn't need to ask which story he meant.
They call me to see if I consider Powell a suspect in Carrie's disappearance.
And what did you say?
Not any questions concerning Miss Lynch should be directed to the police department where she lives.
Very diplomatic.
Except the reporter's no idiot. Her follow-up was whether we were still prosecuting Powell.
And?
I said the case was on hold pursuant to a court order.
So why are you calling me?
Who else am I supposed to vent to? Don't you want to know what I found out?
Of course she did.
The guy you met out there is still the lead, Netter. He said Tom Fisher refused to answer any questions about the affair, about where he was last Wednesday night, about Carrie's work for the company, about Oasis's international operations. Blanket invocation of the Fifth. And the realtor who was going to list Carrie's house said Carrie wasn't interested in looking for a new place. She said she wanted to, quote, take her money and get out of Dodge.
But why would she leave without her stuff, or even her dog? And what's Fisher hiding? Carrie had been missing for a week.
Exactly. So I called Janice Martinez, who said she was about to contact me because the same reporter had reached out to her. She wouldn't give me exact conversations with Carrie, but she said Carrie had been missing long enough that she was willing to share information she believed I needed. Apparently, Martinez notified Olivia Randall on Wednesday that Carrie was amenable to settling the civil case with an eye toward dismissing the criminal case, if the price was right.
She was going to take a payoff, just like we suspected.
Exactly. But Martinez was also working out a settlement with Oasis, negotiating directly with Tom Fisher, not his counsel. In theory, it was to settle potential discrimination claims arising from Carrie's affair with Fisher. But the settlement would include a blanket non-disclosure agreement as to all matters involving her work at Oasis. Martinez says she got a feeling from both Carrie and Fisher that there was some subtext she was missing.
Corinne filled in the blanks. Carrie would keep her mouth shut about the company's kickbacks. She was basically shaking down 2 different men. One for sexual assaults, one for whatever's been going on at that company.
Except now it's starting to look like one of the men is innocent. Jason Powell has been trying to convince us the whole time, telling us about Fisher, even sending us his movie rental receipts. Meanwhile, Fisher's the one invoking. So if one of them is responsible for whatever happened to Carrie, I know where I'd put my money. Maybe Fisher decided her price was too high. Or thought Carrie would keep coming back for more.
When are they running their story?
Any second. They'll go online first, front page tomorrow. The other news outlets will follow. I sat down and took a fresh look at it all. The fact of the matter is this. If I had known at the outset everything I know now, I never would have charged Powell.
So what should you do about that?
I know what I should do. Dismiss this case immediately, at least until they find Carrie. What I'm allowed to do by my boss is another question.
Corinne finished the next paragraph of the supplemental report she'd been writing, but couldn't stop thinking about what she had learned about Tom Fisher. Nick Lowe, the restaurant delivery guy, said he'd seen Jason and Carrie together at her home months ago, in which case Powell was telling the truth about their affair. And yet there were no text messages or emails to suggest a romantic connection. According to him, Carrie was paranoid about her phone and computer usage because she thought her company was looking for an excuse to fire her. But what if she had other reasons for concern? She opened her browser and searched for Oasis Water Africa. She learned from press releases on the company's website that Oasis had been granted contracts in Tanzania and Mozambique a little more than 3 years ago, which would have been around the time Carrie was dating her boss. Corinne picked up her phone and called Nutter.
"I was wondering if that might be you when I saw the number," he said once she identified herself. "I spoke to your ADA not an hour ago."
"Sounds like you're making progress with Fisher."
"That's overly generous. He's not talking."
"I assume you've got Carrie's financial records by now?"
"Yep. No recent large withdrawals. It's looking less and less like she left voluntarily."
"What about deposits?"
"Just direct deposits from work. Are you talking about the settlements her lawyer was trying to work out with Powell and Fisher? She said they hadn't talked final numbers yet."
"But Nick Lowe says Fisher was at Carrie's house that night. Given their history, maybe they were trying to work something out directly without their lawyers."
"We're working on the same theory here. Only thing is, he's a rich man. Buying off an ex-mistress wouldn't have caused much."
"Unless she was in a position to make him a much less rich man, or get him in trouble with the feds."
"You're talking about all that foreign country stuff with the company?"
"Powell claims that Carrie kept promising to help improve his suspicions, but maybe she wasn't merely going to snoop around on his behalf. She was sleeping with her boss when the company got those contracts in Africa."
"You think she actually knew about kickbacks?"
"Or was even involved. That's why I was asking about her bank records. You mentioned her paychecks were on direct deposit. Can you go back a few years and look for anything unusual?"
"Yeah, I've got the bank info right here."
"It shouldn't take long."
She managed to type another section of her report, phone tucked between shoulder and ear, while Nutter did the research.
"Oh, looks like you might have been onto something. She got a huge raise about 3.5 years ago."
As he recited the numbers, Corinne figured out that it was about a 20% raise, issued only a month before Oasis announced new projects in Africa. Corinne pulled up Carrie's profile on LinkedIn.
"I don't see a corresponding promotion listed on her resume," Corinne said. "She's been the VP in charge of global marketing for 5 years.
Plus, her year-end bonus wasn't even 100 grand when it was 20 the previous 2 years."
"And since then?"
"50.
The financial information wasn't a smoking gun, but it was consistent with Corinne's current theory. If there was corruption involved in Oasis's international projects, Carrie Lynch could have been complicit. She had told a realtor that she wanted to sell her house and leave town. Corinne had a feeling that the money Carrie's attorney was seeking to settle a sexual discrimination claim was nothing compared to what Carrie might have tried to extract from Tom Fisher directly when he came to her house. The images Corinne had been seeing for days flashed in her mind again, but this time she saw the face of the man holding the crystal egg over Carrie's head. It belonged to Tom Fisher, not Jason Powell. She told Netter she thought he was on the right track and ended the call. She immediately dialed Brian King. It took only a few minutes to lay out what she had learned.
"I feel better about my decision now," he said.
"Which is?"
"I need to dismiss our case against Powell. Maybe he did it, maybe he didn't, but I have too many doubts to continue the prosecution any longer."
As Corinne hung up the phone, she said a little prayer for both Angela Powell and Carrie Lynch.
53.
"Spencer, you weren't kidding. These clothes smell like rotting fish."
I had just pulled Spencer's camp laundry from the dryer, and every single item was still saturated in the same putrid scent. "Seriously, how is this possible?" I threw them back into the washing machine for a second tour, adding another capful of detergent. Spencer had come home from camp 2 days earlier. His presence, more than anything, made the house feel as close to normal as I could remember in the last month. I had told him that Jason had been charged with a crime, but the case had been placed on hold to reach a settlement. It made it all sound so nice and neat, like an ordinary transaction to be resolved by contract.
To be safe, I had also mentioned that the woman had apparently gone off the grid,
and the police had come by to make sure that Jason's whereabouts could be accounted for the night she'd been seen last. Your dad and I had an argument Wednesday, and he stayed with Uncle Colin for the night. I didn't want the police to read into it, so I said he was here at the house when you called. But he was with Colin, so it's the same thing. Spencer seemed to take it all in stride. He was more upset at the thought of moving, but I had enlisted him in searching Zillow and StreetEasy for a rental apartment he might like. It has to be walkable to school, and I was thinking we should find something pet-friendly. Maybe it's time we got a dog. Cliche, I know, to offer my kid a puppy to make up for a divorce, but I was willing to try anything. When he asked me how big an apartment we were looking for,
I realized I still pictured a home office for Jason and enough closet space for both of us. Let's just get a two-bedroom, since it's temporary. Spencer had immediately volunteered to transfer to a public school if we needed to save money. I fibbed and told him that I was only keeping our rent low because rent was money down the drain. Once we were ready to buy, I assured him we'd get something better. I had hit the wash button on the machine when Spencer came rushing from his room, iPad in hand. Mom, that lady's missing. I told you that, Spencer. With all the media attention, she probably took a break for a while. God knows I had thought a few times about running off to a beach on the other side of the world until this all blew over. No, but it's in the news now. You need to read this. It's better to ignore that stuff. In truth, I was fairly certain I had read every single article, tweet, post, or comment written on the internet about Jason since I first heard Rachel Sutton's name. My skin had gotten no thicker as a result. They never know what they're talking about. No, they do know. Listen to this. Despite Lynch's role as the complainant in the pending sexual assault case against renowned economist and author Powell, law enforcement sources say that the current investigation does not implicate Powell as a suspect in Ms. Lynch's disappearance. In fact, the ongoing investigation has cast doubt on the veracity of Ms. Lynch's original claim against Powell. What? I stood next to him and read the article myself. An unnamed former boyfriend of Ms. Lynch was believed to be the last person to see her and had invoked his right to silence rather than answer police questions. The article closed by noting that the New York District Attorney's Office still had a case pending against Jason Powell, but quoted ADA Brian King as saying, "We are taking a close look at developing facts that may affect our decision-making. For now, we want to make absolutely clear that Dr. Powell is not a suspect in the investigation currently ongoing on Long Island. His whereabouts on that night have been accounted for." "By me," I thought, completing the sentence. Spencer was running toward his room. "I'm calling Dad to make sure he knows." It occurred to me that my son hadn't stopped, even for a second, to worry about what had happened to Carrie Lynch. Was empathy developed by nature or nurture? I pushed away the idea. Despite his biology, Spencer was nothing like Charles Franklin. A few minutes later, he was back in the laundry room, cell phone in hand. "Dad wants to talk to you." "Hey, did you see it?" I asked.
"Olivia just texted me about it right before the phone rang. They called her for a comment earlier today about Carrie's disappearance, but she decided it was better to say nothing. She sensed that the tide was on our side."
"Our." I didn't know who that was anymore. "Congratulations." It was an awkward response.
I don't want to get my hopes up, but this might actually be over. Maybe she blackmailed her boss and got enough money to start over somewhere new.
Without telling anyone? Spencer hadn't seemed worried about Carrie, but Jason obviously was. "Are you okay?"
"Yeah."
He sounded sad.
"I miss you, though. Spencer said he wanted to see me, so that's good news."
I was tracing the herringbone pattern of our oak floors with my big toe, wondering how much longer we'd have this amazing house. "Do you want to come over for dinner? I can cook."
"Really? I would love that."
"That should be okay, right? It's for you to see Spencer."
I think it's perfectly normal for two separated co-parents to meet for dinner with their son.
"Good. We'll be here." I went to Agata and Valentina and bought lamb chops, his favorite. On the way home, I called Susanna to cancel our plans to get takeout and watch the next two episodes of Billions. We were binge-watching together. She was rooting for Axe while I was on the side of the government. "And this has nothing to do with that article in the Long Island Press?" she asked. I couldn't put anything past Susanna. "Jason's coming over. For the record, Spencer's the one who invited him. He hasn't seen his father for more than 2 weeks. He seems ready to forgive him."
"He's ready to forgive, or you are?" "Angela, please tell me you're not rethinking this.
I told you, we already filed out all the paperwork and have a rough agreement sketched out. The lawyers crunching the numbers. You wanted me to protect myself and Spencer, and I am. We're getting divorced. The house is for sale, and I haven't forgotten what Jason did to me. But I never said I didn't love him." While the lamb was roasting, I put on the pale yellow linen dress that Jason had bought me last summer as my anniversary gift, hoping he'd recognize it. He had told that woman, a horrible woman who had been willing to destroy his life and mine, that he would leave me for her. Maybe it was cruel, but I wanted to make him want me. By the time he arrived for dinner, he had gotten another piece of good news. The district attorney's office was dismissing the charges against him. Part 4. Angela. 54. 5 weeks later. That day's appointment with Dr. Boyle was a joint session without Spencer. We all had individual sessions in addition to our couples therapy and the occasional joint family discussions. Basically, we had been living in Dr. Boyle's office for the last month. We were also living in two apartments in adjacent towers on Mercer Street. His two-bedroom was in 250 Mercer, mine in 300. Spencer had rooms in both. Our most recent couple session had been spent going over finances. If all went according to plan, we'd close on the carriage house next week. Jason referred to the 30-year-old buyer who was paying cash with his hedge fund money as Satan. All I cared about was that after a bidding war, he was paying $250,000 more than asking. We'd walk away with nearly $2 million in cash after the mortgage and taxes. To maximize the amount of money going to me, I was taking not only my half, but also a lump sum alimony payment, which meant I'd get almost all of the proceeds from the house. Our divorce decree also gave me half of Jason's retirement account. Now, we were back here with Boyle again. "About to end your marriage," Dr. Boyle said. "How do you feel about that, Jason?"
"Terrible, obviously. I know this is my fault. I never would have left you, Angela."
I looked down at my lap to avoid crying. "I know."
"Angela, you've been very clear that you initiated this divorce for practical reasons, more than emotional ones. But the circumstances have changed since you first reached this decision, have they not? And yet you're still going forward with the divorce. Would you like to talk about that?"
After Jason's criminal case was dismissed, Olivia got Carrie's lawsuit dismissed too, based on her unavailability. Rachel Sutton had accepted a $7,500 settlement in exchange for dismissing her claims and a mutual non-disclosure agreement over what I still believed was a genuine misunderstanding in Jason's office. A combination of a mistimed change of clothing and a habit Jason may have formed of being a little too cute around attractive women. "Maybe it's from living all those weeks under a microscope," I said, "but we still have no idea how this is going to play out. Carrie's still missing." The case dismissals were without prejudice, meaning they could technically be reinstated later. They haven't officially named Tom Fisher as a suspect. Any way you look at it, this is the sensible thing to do. Jason was still on the faculty at NYU, having agreed to a 1-year research leave at half pay for the coming year. He also still had FSS Consulting, where he had lost some clients, but was developing others. A week earlier, FSS and two of Jason's investment clients had filed a lawsuit against Oasis for fraud, arguing that Oasis had failed to disclose material information about deals they had closed for water projects in Africa. Jason's decision to back what he now alleged was a corrupt corporation was a minor dent in his reputation, but it paled in comparison to the earlier allegations. Meanwhile, the news coverage of his lawsuit against Oasis fueled media speculation that Carrie's disappearance, as well as her seemingly false accusation against Jason, was tied to her work with Tom Fisher. It also sold a lot of books. Equalonomics was back on the New York Times list. I was taking the bulk of our money, at least technically, but Jason would be back on his feet in no time. Olivia Randall was confident that the DA's office would never agree to reissue Jason's charges when and if Carrie reappeared. As for Carrie's civil charges, the statute of limitations was a year. If they weren't brought again by then, we wouldn't need to worry any longer about her shaking us down for money, and Jason and I would be free to marry again.
"Did you tell Spencer you were signing today?" Boyle asked.
Spencer was spending the week with my mother in East Hampton, enrolled in sports camp. "We'll tell him this weekend in person. We're both going out to pick him up."
"I have to ask you, Angela, do you think it's possible you're using this arrangement to avoid saying that what you really want is to end your relationship with Jason?"
I shook my head. Jason knows how I feel about him. Before we left the office, Dr. Boyle called in his receptionist, who acted as a witness to our signatures. Once the lawyer filed the papers, it would be official. We were getting divorced. We walked the 6 blocks back to our apartments together, reaching his building first.
"Do you want to come up?"
he asked. I didn't have Spencer as an excuse to go home. I could almost feel the papers tucked into my purse, pressing into my side. They weren't filed yet. "Yeah, that sounds good."
"You're sure?"
"Yes, and if I'm ever not sure, I'm going to tell you. The first time was right after we accepted the offer on the carriage house. when it became clear we were really going through with the divorce. He came over to say goodbye to our home. He held me while we both cried, and when he kissed me, I could tell where it was heading. When I took a step back, he started to apologize, but I told him not to stop. Before I led him to our room, I asked him to let me set the pace. In return, he asked me to promise to stop if at any second I was feeling uncomfortable. This would be my third time up to his apartment since. When we were done, he asked me what had changed. We need to go back to Boyle to have that conversation. Please don't ever say his name while I'm naked. Come on, Jason, what do you mean? Everything has changed. I know. He pulled me into the crook of his arm and I curled up against him.
I meant, what's changed about this? You were never like this before.
Wasn't I? I suppose not. Maybe it was a day with Colin, which I would never tell anyone about. Yes, I was, I said. You just don't remember.
I'm so glad we're back together again.
I felt a wave of nausea, not like the flashbacks. To my surprise, I hadn't experienced anything close to one of those. I felt sick, not about the past, but about the present. Jason believed we were back together only minutes after signing divorce papers, all because I had slept with him a few times. Those 3 years when we had stopped doing this, were we not together? Me too, I said. The next year is going to feel like an eternity.
There's something I haven't told you, and I don't want there to be any secrets between us anymore.
I swallowed, knowing there would never be an end to the lies.
I told her about you,
he said quietly, staring up at the ceiling.
About what happened to you in Pittsburgh. Not everything. I didn't tell her about Spencer, but she knows about Charles Franklin.
I clenched my eyes shut, not wanting to process the implications of what he was telling me.
I'm so sorry, Angela. She was making you out to be an awful wife, and it just came out. I don't know what I was thinking, but I owe you the truth. Carrie's still out there somewhere, and she knows.
My whole body began to shake. I didn't want to think about where Carrie was now. The apartment's air conditioning was struggling against the heat outside, but I felt as if I were standing in a freezer. I pulled the blankets up to my neck and forced myself to regain control. You didn't tell her about Spencer? Only about me. I would never have told Jason the truth about Spencer, except for the problems I had carrying a baby after we got married. My condition wasn't temporary. It was structural, according to the doctors, an anomaly in the uterus. Not insurmountable, but how could I explain my difficulties bringing a child to term under the most privileged medical conditions on the literal planet when I hadn't supposedly given birth in captivity as a crime victim? He didn't understand why I wouldn't keep trying. So I had to tell Jason. A year after Charlie kidnapped me, Sarah showed up. Spencer was born the following year. When we had to leave the house after the police came, Charlie decided that two girls and a baby was too specific a description. He killed Sarah and kept me and Spencer. Most of what I told the police was true, I explained, except Sarah was the one who got pregnant, not me. But she was younger and always a little bit off, and I had taken care of the baby at least as much as she had. That was Charlie's logic, at least. When the rescue team descended on Niagara Falls, my only goal was to protect Spencer and keep him with me. I said he was mine. That's why Mom said she'd sue everyone on site if they tried to examine us physically. Spencer didn't have my blood, but I was the only family he had left.
I swear on my life, Jason promised now. I will take the truth about our son to the grave. But to have spoken even a word about your past to her was a terrible betrayal. It wasn't my story to tell.
I nodded, imagining their conversation. Carrie running me down, trying to convince Jason to marry her. Jason explaining that there were things about me she didn't understand. But he had stopped short of telling her everything. Well, there's nothing we can do about it now, I guess. The cavalier words were overcompensation for the emotions I was fighting to control. Maybe she has 1 ounce of decency and will keep it to herself.
I'd do anything to turn back the clock and change all this, he said.
He had no idea how much I wanted that too. The room became quiet. And I stood up to get dressed.
I meant what I said before, he said softly. I would have never left you.
Maybe not, I thought, but that's not.